This meeting is now being recorded.
Hi, everyone. So thanks very much to everyone who's joined us for this meeting to discuss our first draft for the transparency report for the cross-community working group. So you should have gotten the document via email, and it's in front of you now. I'm going to suggest that we just sort of dive right in and start talking about, basically just to go section by section. And first, we'll talk about each section to see if anybody has specific feedback and to discuss some questions and issues that have been raised. And I was hoping to allow a little bit of time just at the end to just sort of ask you guys what you guys have thought of the process so far and to solicit any feedback on avenues forward. So with that being said, I'm going to skip over discussion of the executive summary at the moment unless anybody has particular areas they want to address because I mean, really, the executive summary is going to, if there are issues, then they're in the body of the paper, then that'll change the executive summary, and we're really just looking at a summary of what's there. So not seeing any objections, I'm going to move us along to another section, which I think hopefully should be fairly straightforward, because it probably doesn't bring up any major policy challenges. Which is the sort of the little background on transparency and the right to information. And again, I'm going to pause and see if anybody has any specific feedback on that. I don't expect that this one will be that controversial. Oh, Ed Morris just sent some comments. All right. Well, in any case, hopefully someone, maybe Chris, you can, or someone else can take a look at that. While I'm sort of moving through this. So anybody on background on transparency and the right to information? Okay, good. I didn't think that would be too controversial. So moving into the more substantive type things. The first section... the first sort of substantive section, including the recommendations, was on reforming the DIDP. And obviously a lot of people provided feedback and inputs on this, which was very helpful. So I'm going to just start by, I guess, throwing it open a little bit and asking what people's thoughts are. Or I guess while people are trying to sort of get their thoughts together, maybe I can start with a comment that we got in from Brett. Which is to say, as far from what I understand, ICANN sometimes denies DIDP requests if the information is already publicly available. And Brett has suggested that we include a requirement in their denial. If you request information that is already publicly available elsewhere, that there should be a requirement for ICANN to direct the requester to where that information is. And I think that's an excellent idea. And I was planning to include that unless there are any objections. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. So let's pass that over to David while I try to take a look at what Ed has said. David, do you want to?
Thanks, Michael. It's David McCauley for the transcript purposes. by and large, I think it's a sensible – I mean, I was thinking of – what happens when the information is publicly available as well. And my experience, and some of the others on this group share the experience of working in CCWG on accountability workstream one, where there was just a flood of information. And sometimes it was hard, excuse me, to find a particular email that might have some impact on an issue that was discussed in month one but came back up again in month eight. And it was present some difficulties. But my concern when I thought about it was, is we have to have a mechanism, or we should have a mechanism, I think, to make sure that people invoking DIDP don't look to ICANN to do their research for them. And so I think it's a reasonable request on the one hand, but I can see how it could be abused on the other. And so I guess what I'm saying is we should be cautious how we approach the subject. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, David. There is, I think, an exception within ICANN or within the DIDP for requests which are unduly burdensome, I think. I don't have it on me now, and I definitely should have. But I think that that might be covered under the vexatious request, but that's certainly, I think, a very legitimate concern. Does anybody else want to comment on that? I think what I might suggest as a potential way to sort of address that, because I'm sort of viewing this process as being kind of a dialogue with ICANN where we're going to present particular recommendations, and I assume that the staff who are actually going to have to implement this will have their own response. What I might suggest is that we sort of present Brett's recommendation and then see how it's received by ICANN, to see if they think that it would be an institutional problem. Good idea, bad idea? Maybe, David, do you think that would solve your problem? Or potentially, I mean, we could explicitly label that, you know, within administrative, a similar requirement to we have in the vexatious thing, where, like, so long as this doesn't constitute an undue administrative burden to... Okay, David says he's happy with it. I can't look back, I think.
Michael, I got off mute though since you asked me, so I thought I think it is a good idea, and I think it would be a good idea, especially since in the area of vexatious requests, we're sort of trimming that a bit, which is fine. I mean, we have to be careful on that side too, but yes, I think it's a great idea. Again, I can't beat back in this sub-team and some others as well. Thank you.
Yeah, certainly. Okay, great. So I think that's great that we've gotten. So Avery is saying, I worry about documents that cannot be found for any search methods and an expansive notion and use of vexatious request accusations. So we are hoping to narrow, I wouldn't necessarily call it narrowing the scope of the vexatious. Actually, we are narrowing the scope. But the main change that we're making to the question of vexatious responses is that we're requiring permission from the ombudsman before that exception is invoked. And that sort of is our, is basically a way of saying, first of all, that we recognize very much that that can be a legitimate exception, but also to try to ensure that it's not abusively invoked. So that's one of the things that we've done. And I think we also, memory serves, did trim it slightly. Just double check that. We trimmed it in order to allow for unduly burdensome requests, but to remove we are still allowing unduly burdensome requests, I think. I believe. So David's asking, what about email archives for a group like CCWG? Do you mean whether those would be subject to ICANN's requests?
Michael, no. I was engaging in a chat with Aubrey, and Aubrey had made the point that she was worried about documents that can't be found through reasonable search method, et cetera, you know, and putting that burden on the requester. And I made the point in return that wouldn't ICANN face that same hurdle. And the example that I was using was email archives. CCWG for accountability is an excellent example, because it's just mountains of emails, and many of them very, very important in later deliberations. I also might mention one other thing. I think what this is going to raise at some point is the idea, and I'm not saying I'm one way or the other in this, but the idea of cost. For instance, if ICANN is going to be asked to go off and do a bunch of research, is there going to be a mechanism we should discuss at least a mechanism for whether, I don't know, do they charge for DIDP? I've never made such a request for the paper or whatever. So anyway, those are my comments, and it was really in response to a chat entry with Avery. Thank you.
So I would ask the group, because I have to confess I haven't used the DIDP. I guess that's embarrassing, considering I've just been writing this thing about reforming it. I've made a lot of access to information requests in many different contexts, but not through the DIDP. My understanding is that they don't charge costs, but I would be very open to be corrected on that. They don't charge for access. That's in line with what we see in better practice countries, as well as in most international organizations that have access to information policies. In terms of the resources, the short answer is yes, this will cost more money to implement. First of all, we're talking about a shorter time frame, which means that there is going to be greater resources devoted to that. When we make it so that they can't refuse requests just because it would, when we narrow the language on refusing requests, that means more are going to be processed. I mean, I think that, like, inevitably there is going to be some resources that are going to need to be expended in terms of making these changes. It's going to make the system more expensive. But I would argue that this is something that is of structural importance to ICANN, that you cannot be a multi-stakeholder organization with stewardship over a core public resource without fulfilling strong transparency obligations. And what we've seen over the past few months with the suspicion over what ICANN does and the crazy fear-mongering being thrown around about this Russian and Chinese takeover of the Internet, I mean, I saw these stories, and what I saw is this is why you need transparency. You need a transparent organization to make sure that there isn't room for these kinds of rumors to spread. Because if ICANN is an open book, then I think there's much less, it becomes much less of a target for these kinds of conspiracy theories. So that's the argument that I would make, although I do certainly anticipate cost and expense coming up. I'm having a bit of a challenge right now because I'm trying to keep up with the chat as well as hosting, as well as sort of presenting it. But I'm just going to keep moving us along until I see a hand up, if that's all right. We will discuss the recommendations, I guess, together once we get to the end of it. But why don't I push into Ed's recommendations that he's just... I see a question.
Hey, Michael, this is Chris. Let me just, with regard to Ed's recommendations, his email is somewhat lengthy, so it's hard to put it into the chat. I was only able to cut and paste a snippet in there. So I don't know if Bernie or Yvette or Karen or someone maybe could turn his email into a PDF and put it up on the screen or at some point, or put it in the notes section so we all could see it easily. For those that are out, can multitask and look at your email, you can find Ed's email there, but it might be easier for all to put it into the room itself. I don't know if that's feasible. But that says she's working on it now, so that's great. So maybe we can, once that gets up, we can then dive in. Sorry to interrupt.
Thanks so much for that. And also, I mean, please. I mean, it's slightly challenging getting a big lengthy thing just as the meeting's getting started. But I do see a question while we're working on Ed's responses from Jean-Jacques, which asks, when we talk about the ombudsman's mandate to be accurate, Does he have a mandate resulting from a vote, or is it simply his responsibility? So when I refer to the ombudsman's mandate, I do just mean responsibility, not in terms of an elected mandate. I think the ombudsman is just appointed, as far as I understand it. So perhaps the language is troubling, and I'd be happy to shift that to the word responsibility, if that would solve the problem. I see Jean-Jacques handed up.
Thank you, Michael. Hello, this is Jean-Jacques. Yes, because for people who are not as familiar with, say, ICANN, as with perhaps international law, it is puzzling because people may wonder how the ombudsman is actually appointed through a vote. Is it through another mechanism? And that's why I propose that we replace throughout. I haven't read the whole thing, but I suppose that this word is used more than once. It should be changed, I think, to responsibilities. Thank you.
I have no problem with that, and I can, or I'm very happy to institute those changes unless there's any objections. Great. So I think Ed did mention something about the ombudsman, though, which I guess the most useful thing to do is to start going through his comments. Themselves. I see Alan has responded by saying mandate can refer to responsibility due to being elected. It also just means a commission to do something. I mean, I agree with that, but I also, there's a potential that I think that there may be language differences, and I think that responsibility doesn't take anything away from it, which is why I'm very happy to change it. So we're looking at Ed's responses now at the moment. His first one, which I saw and was hoping to throw out there because if it's correct, then this is an important thing. He said that appeals against refusals or other non-compliance with the DIDP are referred for a reconsider request to the IRP rather than to the ombudsman. My understanding was that the appeals were handled by the ombudsman, so if that's incorrect, then that's an important thing to correct. Can anybody else offer any information about that? Because my understanding was that the ombudsman made those decisions. So if that's wrong, then that's a very important clarification to get. And I see a few people here are typing, so why don't I hang back until we hear. Okay, so none of the comments were based on that. I'll tell you what, I will follow up. Okay. I see David's hand up.
Thanks, Michael. I just went to the DIDP page, and there is a section called Appeal of Denials, and it's very short. I'll just read it. It says, to the extent a requester chooses to appeal a denial of information from ICANN, the requester may follow the reconsideration request procedures or IRP procedures to the extent either is applicable as set forth in Article 4, Section 2 and 3 of the bylaws, which can be, and then there's a link to the bylaws.
Okay. I'll tell you what. Why don't I'm not sure this is necessarily going to be settled now, so why don't I dig into this a little bit more deeply and report back. So this is going to be something that I'll have to look into in terms of Ed's email and whether this is incorrect. So why don't we just shelve that, and I will look into it. Why don't we move forward? Emphasis of human rights. Okay, so this is an interesting one. So I think that Ed's second point is that we should avoid the discussion of human rights because that will conflate our mechanism, our process, with the broader discussion of human rights that's already going on. I disagree with this for a few reasons. I do think that it's important to paint access to information as a human right because it is a human right. You know, that was sort of the purpose of that whole initial section, was to present this as more than just a governance issue. This is a fundamental, the fundamental responsibility that ICANN has. If they're going to be managing something as important and as globally significant as this, there is a responsibility there beyond just a matter of good governance. But, you know, I if people think it would be counterproductive, I'd be interested to hear other opinions.
So, Michael, this is
David.
This is Chris. I'm sorry. Sorry, David, go ahead.
Thanks, Chris and Michael. I was just going to say that I agree with Ed. I think that and Michael, one of the reasons you said that it's important to state is because access to information is a fundamental human right. Well, that's the very thing that the HR subteam is debating. And I understood when I read it, and I actually wasn't going to raise the point, but since Ed did, I would just say I agree with him. Thank you very much.
Okay. So from that perspective then, does that mean that the introductory and background section as a whole should be removed, or does that mean that we should be sort of reframing it? I mean, I guess, am I hearing that it should be reframed as a, I see Avery has his hand up. Sorry.
Yeah, I do have my hand up. Thank you. I agree. I think that it's not good to base the requirement for transparency on human rights, because should we get to the point where ICANN can claim that it is not so bound by a human right related to freedom of information, then we lose transparency. So transparency has to stand on a very solid foundation of its own. On the other hand, I think it's fine in a chapeau, in an overview, to talk about the relationship to human rights, but just not to base it on human rights. So if that distinction makes sense, I would suggest taking that kind of approach. But we don't want to get undercut because it's a human right, and it's not one that we're said to have to respect. Thank you.
Okay, so what I'm hearing then is about a need to not necessarily remove all discussion of it as a right, but to reframe it more clearly that we're grounding it in an argument for better governance, which I think can definitely be done. And I don't necessarily have an objection too. Great, and I'm seeing support in the chat, so I will do that. Okay. So why don't we move on to his point number three, which again I think deals with the background section of it, which is to note that ICANN is not a nation state. It is not an IGO. It is not an NGO. The problem is, so he says, he suggesting that the group poses a question to our independent counsel on the following lines, in examining the current defined conditions of non-disclosure, which of the exceptions from disclosure would be necessary to keep so that ICANN remains compliant with California law? Are there any additional documentary items or that may be in ICANN's possession that you believe should be excluded from public access and or inspection on the basis of California statutes. So he's very obviously correct that ICANN is not a country, but the reason why I'm trying to ground it in intergovernmental or national standards is because the California standards are quite weak, frankly. We don't want to base this in an American system because it's going to lead to very poor levels of disclosure, and I think that we can be more ambitious than that. You know, obviously ICANN is subject to California law. If we just ask them to do the bare legal minimum of what California state law requires them to do, I mean, it's not asking them very much, and frankly, it would be, I think, a big step backwards. But I'm open to other people's thoughts, obviously. If you don't
have to stand up. Hello? Yes, sir.
Hello, this is Jean-Jacques. Yes, Michael, I think this is an important point. The problem with referring to an international organization or something resembling that is that then you have to invoke specific international or national law. There's one element which is missing, I think, or doesn't come out strongly enough. It is the responsibility of any organization beyond frontiers or borders, which in fact performs a public service. And in this case, in the case of ICANN, it is a service to the global public worldwide. I'm not formulating it very well. English is not my mother tongue. But if you get the gist of what I'm saying, maybe you can translate that into proper language. So it's the notion of serving the public interest worldwide. Thanks.
Yeah, I understand completely, I think, and I could agree completely that ICANN is the steward over global resources, which gives them this responsibility. The challenge is, when I hear you say that, that immediately, to me, pushes us towards saying, well, this is why it's a responsibility, and it's grounded in the right to information. I mean, that's the ideological grounding of these international responsibilities. It's that you have things like the International Covenant on Political Rights, which recognize the right to access information. You have national laws around the world. You have international treaties and statements by international rapporteurs, Human Rights Committee of the UN, that people have a right to access information. And so, you know, that was how I was trying to ground it originally. But there, I think, was opposition to pushing it towards a human rights position because of confusion with the ongoing discussion of a human rights responsibility. So what about this? What about if I include clarifications about the unique status of ICANN? What if I point back, I retain the discussions of access as a human right and ICANN's responsibilities, but I maintain that our focus on this document is to ground it in ICANN's responsibility. And that being said, like, unless I hear arguments otherwise here, I plead that we add the unique status of ICANN and that it serves the global public interest. Okay, great. Which hopefully is what I was to that, because that's sort of what I was trying to say. So that sounds fantastic. So I think that's a great solution, which Jean-Jacques just mentioned, which is to add a reference to the unique status of ICANN and its a more clear discussion of its role serving the global public. Unless I hear any objections, I think that that's an avenue that we should go on in terms of the background section. And with regard to, well, and I will, you know, obviously I'll circulate more drafts. I'm seeing Chris's hand up.
Thanks, Michael. I just was going to say, I think that's a good plan of attack. I do think with regard to Ed's specific point about interplay with California law, maybe as part of background, do we try to compare and contrast where we are with where the current state of play is, with California. Maybe I missed that in the document, but I think maybe there's an effort to demonstrate why how we are above and beyond what is minimally required in California, to provide, I guess, that a better understanding of contrast might be helpful. I don't know, for folks.
But I mean, as Ed notes, ICANN is a California Public Benefits Corporation. That applies particular standards on ICANN. Now, I assume ICANN is complying with that law. I can't imagine ICANN is violating California law. And I also don't think we necessarily need to try to persuade ICANN to comply with California law, because it would be a pretty big issue if they weren't. But I think that what we're trying to do in this document is to push them significantly beyond that, in light of the fact that they are not just a public benefits corporation, but they also play this crucial public interest role serving the global community and as gatekeepers over this, or not gatekeepers, but stewards over this critically important resource. So this is why I actually find it, I'm a bit concerned by Ed's suggestion here, because if we try to ground this in California law, then essentially we're going to end up arguing for a much weaker standard, and probably a standard that they're already complying with. We're not pushing them forward. I see Alan's hand is up.
Yeah. Thank you. I think the overall thrust of what we're doing does not need to be and shouldn't be to prove that under one statute or another or some set of rules, ICANN must do things. I thought our job is to come up with what we believe is a reasonable level of transparency given ICANN's position as responsible for a key part of the internet, and given its responsibility to consider the global public interest. So I don't think we need to prove that it must do it because of some law or mandate. I think our job is to put together what we think is a reasonable set of expectations given where ICANN sits in the world, and then go through by going through the CCWG accountability and the board, we end up getting it. So I think the whole concept of trying to find the rationale for why they must do it because there is some compelling law or whether it's human rights or a statute under some grounds, I think is the wrong tact. I don't think we need to do that, and if in fact there was some compelling law or equivalent, we wouldn't even have this work group in place to begin with. So I think we're trying to find a reasonable ground, a reasonable set of expectations, and then push them through the process that we're doing. I don't think we can find the law-based or rule-based rationale for doing it. Thank you.
Sure. I mean, thanks so much for that. I agree. I would just maybe put it a little more than reasonable. I would hope we would be like ambitious rather than just reasonable. But I do understand. But I do certainly agree with the idea. And I don't think we're looking for a particular legal framework or legal requirements. But I think that the utility of grounding it back to existing laws or existing standards that are in place elsewhere, even though ICANN is a unique organization, is I'm worried that if we don't say, well, here's how it's done at the World Bank and here's how it's done in the Indian government and this and that, like if we don't have anything proper to ground it under, then it sort of looks like we're just pulling these standards out of the air, as opposed to what I think is a stronger argument, which is to point to the way things are done elsewhere and point to existing examples of better practice and to say, here are appropriate models to follow based on other organizations. I see Alan's hand up again.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I support that completely, but the discussion we seem to be having up until now is to find the rationale why ICANN must do it, as opposed to what you just said of examples and comparable organizations other places of what they do, and we should match that level of transparency and openness. I think those are two different different ways of approaching it, and I strongly favor what you're talking about now of using comparable examples in the World Bank or in governments or whatever, as opposed to saying they must do it based on certain statutes.
Okay, sure. I think this in part this might be, that's great. This, in part this might be my sort of core as an activist coming through, and the fact that I'm used to dealing with nation states, and I'm used to sort of, for lack of a better word, browbeating them into improving their policies. So, you know, I'm used to having to phrase arguments in a very forceful way because I've encountered a lot of resistance from states. Maybe the ICANN process is, doesn't require that same level of force in making your argument. Certainly sympathetic to that. But I think that we seem to have arrived at a degree of consensus on this, which is great. And I think that we also sorry, just going back to Ed's thing again. Looking at number four, which mentions the appeals process. Again, Ed is sort of Ed says he disagrees with me saying with the proposal that ICANN should establish an external oversight panel of three members to hear appeals against CIDP refusals, which would sit on an on-call basis and hear appeals when they come in. Ed says that initial DIDP requests are handled by staff. The board deserves the ability to mend staff and correct improper staff behavior before the matter escalates to an internal panel. And that an initial appeal of a DIDP denial should go to our revised reconsideration process before being escalated to outside parties. That's not necessarily, I think that's not a bad idea. And, you know, comparing to access information systems around the world, an internal appeal is frequently used as a first recourse, so that's not a bad idea. I do think that there needs to be some sort of an independent appeal at some level, whether it's a second phase or beyond that. And whether or not the review panels that I've suggested are the best way to do it, I'm certainly very open to, but I would support adding an internal review in as a first step. And Ed is also suggesting whether a revised IRP process would be suited to your DIDP appeals. I don't know necessarily that much about how the IRP process works, so that's something that I can look into, but I'm very keen to hear what people think. And I see David's hand is up.
Thanks, Michael. It's David McCauley. My understanding of the IRP process is that a DIDP denial would be reviewable at IRP if the denial amounts to a violation of the articles or bylaws. thank you.
So it would be subject to appeal if it potentially violated the bylaws, and presumably that would include if it violated the disclosure policy. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. The bylaws actually speak about IRP in the context of a DIDP denial, and the section is 4.3B, just one second, B, it's under the definition of disputes in the IRP portion of the bylaw, and under disputes it says one of the things that would be covered is if the action resulted from a response to a DIDP request that is claimed to be inconsistent with the articles of incorporation or bylaws, and that's it. Now, violating the disclosure policy would, in all likelihood, be a violation of the articles. But I'm just making guessing at that. I haven't briefed that or no one to know about that. But that's the standard that I just read.
Okay, and can I ask, does anybody know, and again, I apologize for my ignorance on this, but the IRP processes, who are the decision makers in those processes? Does anybody have a clearer understanding of how those work?
I can speak to that as well. It's David McCauley again. The IRP is an independent panel, basically. And I would disagree with the point that you made earlier that you need something independent. In my view, this will be independent. And it's under Article 4 of the bylaws. And what it amounts to is a panel of three arbitrators out of a standing panel of at least seven arbitrators. And these are people that, you know, are objective and skilled. There's a certain skill level they have in training, et cetera, knowledge of the DNS and all that kind of stuff. But these are independent. And one of the knocks on IRP before the transition was that the standard was ineffectual, but the standard's been changed, and now there is a substantive review of claims, and there is a mechanism for the empowered community to enforce these decisions. And so it would be a panel of judges, basically, panel of arbitrators. You could look at it that way.
Okay, so that does sound a lot better. So that sounds reasonably independent. There would be questions about the expertise of the IRP people. Potentially, we could ask that they have some of included in their qualifications for serving on the IRP, that we should include access information or understanding of rights information transparency issues as one of the criteria by which these guys are appointed. But what I'm hearing is, first of all, in terms of the initial recommendation of having an internal appeal, it seems like people support that, which is good, and I'll add that in. In terms of the secondary one, it sounds like we should be directing this to the IRPs rather than to an external appeal panel, from what I'm hearing, sounds good as well. So I'd be happy to edit it along those lines after I just do a little bit more research myself. So we've dealt with Ed's inputs. I'm going to move it back to the DIDP. I guess we've eaten up a lot of time on this, but I'm going to move it back to the DIDP very quickly, to the broader section, to ask if there's any other issues that people want to raise. Okay. Oh, I see David again.
Thanks. It's David again. Sorry to take up so much time, but in the document, which, by the way, I'm very grateful to you for, I think it's very well done. In the document, there is on page 6 of 18, at least that's how I print it, roughly on page 6, it says, in the specific context of the right to information, this translates into a similar three-part test, and then there's three bullets with the test. And as I read the test, and the third bullet says, the harm to the interest must be greater than the public interest in accessing the information, and the public interest must override. My question to you, Michael, is, what about non-disclosure agreements that ICANN enters into with business partners? Are we clear that those are covered as things that ICANN need not disclose? That's one question. Counterbalanced against it, I guess some people may be concerned that ICANN, if that's the case, may abuse the non-disclosure agreement process. But I was just wondering, what were your thoughts when you wrote this about non-disclosure agreements? Thank you.
I think that that's a major issue. The weird thing is, looking at the DIDP right now, I'm not sure how they're going to withhold information that's subject to non-disclosure agreement. I do need to go through it again, but I'm not sure if they have the proper procedure there. That being said, the abusive use of non-disclosure agreements is a huge potential concern. And I think that I would suggest that we should include a specific discussion on that. I was going to put that under proactive disclosure because Chris already touched on it in that section, but basically a need that ICANN should not be entering into non-disclosure agreements except where it's absolutely necessary for external reasons. And you know, countries all over the world, in their contracting, they live by requirements of transparency, whereby if you sign some kind of if you submit a tender or whatever to a state government, there are expectations of transparency that are not the same than if you perform a similar business task along with a private company. And I think that we should be pushing ICANN to consider themselves subject to embracing a similar kind of standard rather than the private sector approach. I see David's hand is up again.
Thank you, Michael. Very quickly. I tend to disagree with what you said in the latter point, but with respect to abusive use, and when I read the document, I thought that the issue may come up, abusive use of non-disclosure agreements. When you write up something on that, I would suggest that one alternative that we at least look at is, if we think it's an issue, that it be something that that it be an appeal that's vested in the empowered community. It seems to me that'd be something important enough that the empowered community would want to take care of that, rather than an individualized DIDP appeal. I'm sure there'll be other thoughts on it, but that's a suggestion. Thank you.
Do you mean an appeal to do you mean an appeal on reviewing the disclosure agreement, or an appeal to when the disclosure agreement should be entered into?
No, I'm sorry. I was making reference to the idea that if you're going to rewrite this with abusive use of non-disclosures in mind, in that particular subject area, if it ever became an issue, that it would be something that the empowered community may want to address. It's just an alternative for us to consider, that's all. And the empowered community can make appeals to the IRP.
Sure. I mean, I see a challenge here. Well, first of all, to clarify, like, I don't think ICANN should be going back and rewriting contract to Tel Aviv tonight. If ICANN signed a non-disclosure agreement last year on a particular issue, I mean, I don't, you know, if it signed a contract, I think it's reasonable to expect that they're going to live by their word on that. But to me, it's about going forward and ensuring that non-disclosure agreements aren't entered into. And Chris has, I think, raised a very interesting idea, which is to consider certain subject matters with a presumption against non-disclosure. I think that's a very interesting idea. I see Alan's hand is up.
Yeah, thank you. Two things. First of all, non-disclosure clauses in contracts are a part of business in many ways. You know, there's all sorts of things that you know, including software that you have to sign certain, or commit to keeping certain things confidential. So I don't think we can stop ICANN from doing that. I don't think we want to stop ICANN from doing it. Using it abusively is a different issue altogether. And, wording like that would be good, but I think we have to accept the fact that some level of confidentiality is going to be associated with contracts that ICANN signs. And I don't think we can pretend anything else other than that. Thank you.
I don't think anyone would argue with doing away with it entirely. It's just about minimizing it to the extent that it's absolutely necessary. And again, I think it's about pushing them beyond a standard that we would accept from any other business because of the public interest aspect of what they do. But that's something that we'll think about more carefully. I think, given that it's 4:50, we should push onwards, although I'm really enjoying this discussion. I think that we should push onwards to Section 3 on proactive disclosure. And I have to apologize because we haven't quite finished this section. Chris did a wonderful write-up, and I was supposed to add some sections to it, which I haven't been able to do yet. Probably dealing with budget transparency and the like. So that being said, are there any comments on what we have on sub-theme 2 regarding proactive disclosure policies?
Michael,
I guess it's a little bit tough. Please.
Sorry, Michael. This is Chris. I know Brett had raised a question in his email, I guess, from a few days ago with regard to this section.
Right.
I mean, specifically asking that we clarify that or make it clear that we're including I think he was including the education engagement type of vendors in the disclosure, and I think that's certainly the intention. If we want to write it more clearly, I can certainly attempt to do that. But I should also note that in engaging a little bit of dialogue with Xavier Calvez, our ICANN CFO, to get a little more information about what exactly these types of vendors are, et cetera. It seemingly that this notion of education engagement vendor has really only come up in one context, and that is with regard to the IANA transition, and seemingly only has come up, I guess, in FY15. And so I think the point of this disclosure is not to get wrapped around the axle of the education engagement vendor per se, though that is captured, but also to capture other internal and external use of people to interact with governments, if you will. And so obviously those particular vendors with regard to the INA transition certainly fall within that context. But I think we need to be careful of not drawing it too narrowly, where we're only talking about that sort of limited subset of individuals or companies, et cetera. And obviously, I think with going to the notion of non-disclosure agreements, I think this is a subject matter, if you will, that augurs for leaning towards disclosure rather than not. So I think notwithstanding that there are business practices and understanding that there's confidentiality requirements, we also know, I think it's important that we have these types of disclosures. And I should say, if any of these vendors happen to be some of the top five, quote-unquote, highest paid contractors from ICANN, ICANN is obligated under law to report them in their 990. So, and indeed ICANN has a policy of over-disclosing in that sense that they were disclosing contractors above $1 million reporting threshold. I think we've sort of learned that waivers are not necessarily sought, confidentiality waivers are not necessarily sought for that disclosure either. So I think there's some precedent here for this. Obviously, we have disclosing of vendors. I can wordsmith it a little bit more if we want to make it clear who we're talking about. But I also think we need to be careful about not overly circumscribing where we are and not being too narrow in our definitions. So I just want to throw that out there and then sort of acknowledge Brett's email from earlier in the week. Thanks.
Okay, great. Unless there's anything else on the proactive disclosure thing, thanks so much for bringing up Brett's email, which is very good and which I think we can. Unless there's anything else on that, I do want to move forward to whistleblower protection because I see that Barbara's here. I did such a great job drafting this, and so I want to make sure we have a bit of a chance to discuss it, and with particular reference to the areas of discussion that she raised. I see Jean-Jacques' hand is up.
Yes, thank you, Michael. This is Jean-Jacques speaking. I should have reacted a minute ago. Sorry for being late, but it's still about sub-theme 2, proactive disclosure policies. And I notice on, I think, paragraph 4, that there is a mention of IANA transition. And I think that throughout the text, we have to be very careful, especially in light of the a fuss which was made in the Senate and the Congress in recent weeks just before transition. We're not talking about the transition of IANA. We're talking about the transition of oversight of the IANA functions, etc. Thank you. This is important.
This is Chris. That is an important distinction. I think when we use the term IANA transition, it's sort of shorthand for the actual oversight of the IANA function. And I think it also, when you speak of the IANA transition, we talk more generally also about the accountability reforms, et cetera, et cetera. So it stands for more than just the actual IANA functions contract. But obviously, we can be more clear on exactly what we're talking about. And really, and this disclosure, by the way, is meant to go beyond whatever engagement took place with regard to the IANA contract itself. It's intended to be other interactions with governments. I think there's a footnote in the document that speaks of the former CEO's interactions with China with regard to the World Internet Conference, as well as his interactions with Brazil with regard to the Net Mondial Conference from 2.5 years ago. So we're not talking specifically about the IANA contract, but obviously to the extent that we mention it, we can certainly be more clear about what we're talking about. So I appreciate the feedback.
Okay, So I, without getting, I do want to move us forward, just because I do want to get a chance to talk about the whistleblower protection, because it's really important that we consider whether we want to accept the NAVEX's recommendations or not. The way that it's currently drafted is basically following the NAVEX recommendations and supporting them. I think that that's the right approach to take, but hopefully that the community can talk a little bit about, that we can have some discussions whether people think that we've taken the right approach on that. I see Jean-Jacques' hand is up. Okay, I see Jean-Jacques' hand is down. Are there any thoughts about the whistleblower protection section? I think that this was very well drafted. I had a few tiny issues, but I don't want to be talked for the whole time, so I really want to make sure that anybody else who wants to raise any concerns or questions has a chance to. So please, Barbara.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear.
Great, okay. As I said, I think in my email to the group, there's no pride in authorship here, so I welcome any edits that people want to make to this. What I tried to do, particularly under the first section, is express my own frustration about trying to actually find this policy on the ICANN website. So I just offered, you know, some practical suggestions about how one they could improve the ability for a member of the ICANN community to do a search for this on the ICANN website. But the area where I would really welcome the input from this group concerns the scope. Now, the NAVEX report recommended that the hotline policy be opened up, if you will, and made accessible to business partners, and they offer a definition of what business partners is. Would constitute. And I heard one comment from one member of our group, Mr. Holmquist, Ricardo Holmquist, and I think he's on the call today. And I welcome his comments, but he had concerns with that on grounds that actually I even redlined the text to incorporate his concerns. That the only ones that should have access to the hotline other than employees might be temporary workers, that the way in which business partners is defined would make it too all-encompassing, could open it up to registries, registrars, governments, and so on. And so I propose some red line text. If people also share his concerns that scope is too broad, and happy to share that with the group. But other than that, I am very, very open to any other comments people have concerning this draft, and yours in particular, Michael. So I just wanted to cite and acknowledge Mr. Holmquist's input. Thank you.
So just until we see another hand, because again, I don't want this call to be just me talking. I don't necessarily see the harm in broader application and in allowing people from broader backgrounds to use the hotline. I don't necessarily see a negative to that. But certainly the idea of visibility is there. I see David, so let's hand over because it's great to get more perspectives.
Thanks, Michael. It's David. I think the document of whistleblower is well done, but I have to say I read it very quickly, having spent a lot of time on DIDP. So my request would be that we also make sure that we bring this up in the next call. Thank you.
Sure, absolutely. I see Ricardo, so maybe he wants to follow up on the commentary that he made.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, the comment is the business partner that they are including in the NAVEX recommendation. They include things like temporary worker, and I agree. But they agree also broader ecosystem of business partners, and some of them maybe should be going to the ombudsman or any different claim than the whistleblower, as I understand. Because business partner, they open it like anyone that has a contract with ICANN, and this includes any registry and all this ecosystem of internet relationship, instead of a real business partner in this case, like a federal agency or whatever, that is a kind of supplier of ICANN. So I guess that, I guess not. I recommend that we divide the business partner. One thing is that the ones are suppliers to ICANN, and the other thing is the ecosystem of ICANN that's internet related, that is very different. That's the ones that ICANN give them a service. And sorry for my English.
I definitely think there needs to be more clarity over who the hotline is available to. That was one of the things that jumped out to me, was that I think it was like third parties as defined by ICANN, which seems to be a bit of a vague standard. So certainly I think that we should try to clarify that. But I really would ask, what is the harm with having more people have access to this? Like, I'm sympathetic to the idea that certain people, there's an ombudsman route as well. If they also had access to this hotline, like, I'm not seeing that, but I'm very curious to get the rationale for narrowing it. I see we're running up against the end of the time, as David has pointed out, and that none, but we should divide who goes to the whistleblower and who goes to the... Sure, okay. So we'll look for better definitions as well. Time check, top of the hour, of course. Just before we go, I just wanted to mention very, very briefly, in terms of our avenue forward, I think that we had originally... ICANN broadly wants to get a copy of this, and they had originally asked us, I think, for a copy for general circulation by today. And what I'm going to suggest is that the rapporteurs take another crack at it, basically based on some of the feedback that we've gotten today, and then produce a copy that's for general circulation on Monday, if there are no objections to that. Because... there are concerns from ICANN that, like, they want a copy so that they can review it before the end of before Hyderabad. And if we wait until the next call and then post after that, then we're, I think, basically just on the flight. Sorry, CCWG. Ah, sorry, my bad. As long as it shows draft. Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely do that. Okay. So well, that sounds good to me.
Yeah,
I see Alan's hand is up.
Yeah, I was just going to basically say that I have no problem with the rapporteurs creating the next version, but it should note, you know, on where it says draft not reviewed by this working group yet. We don't want to be in a position where you say something in good faith, but it may be significantly disagreed with, and we haven't had a chance to expose that. So it should just have the byline saying it hasn't been reviewed by this group yet.
Well, I get that, but we've also had substantial feedback from the group, and we're basing our revisions based on that.
So
to me, it's a bit... Like, I don't want to, like, I'm happy to call it a draft, and I'm also happy to put a footnote in to talk about, why don't I put a footnote at the top that clarifies the process and how this was done, and says that the latest draft was done based on this feedback, and the rapporteurs prepared a new draft for Monday. Like, I'm very happy.
That's fine with me.
Okay. So unless there's anything else, I'm going to suggest that we call it here. And thanks very much for this wonderful discussion, which I obviously enjoyed. And I look forward to further engagement on this.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.